antidiarrheal medications, flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief. They were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
Israel's economy is now in a crisis, as it was hit by a double whammy this year: the so-called judicial overhaul and the U.S.-Israel genocidal war. Local stocks have underperformed global stocks this year. At the beginning of the year, the local stock market was shadowed by growing political uncertainty around the proposed judicial overhaul. The planned proposal sparked fears that the changes to the regime's legal system would threaten the independence of the judiciary and make business and investments less predictable. Over the course of the year, total equity raised from the public plunged to about 8.2 billion shekels from 21.7 billion shekels in 2022, while the average daily trading volume was down 12% year on year. The public withdrew a massive 30 billion shekels from funds that invest in shares and bonds in Tel Aviv, and poured 20.5 billion shekels into funds that invest in securities abroad. And following Israel's genocide in Gaza and the ensuing hostilities, Israeli securities initially dropped and the shekel plunged to the weakest level in more than a decade.
The social media platform X has provided a vital lifeline to journalists debunking Israel's disinformation around its genocidal war on Gaza. Several lies that Israeli occupation forces pushed out were immediately discredited by investigative journalists on the site. For that reason, Elon Musk is simultaneously a key ally and target of the Zionist regime. Musk has been mobilized against by key Zionist lobby groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And it is likely that his visit was an opportunity for the Zionist regime to apply more pressure on him to censor the social media platform. During the short pause in Israel's bombing of Gaza, the billionaire owner of the platform X, Elon Musk, traveled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for an indoctrination session. While in occupied Palestine, he was taken on a guided tour of the Gaza settlement envelope by Netanyahu. A solemn picture was taken with Musk looking down at a baby cot, supposedly littered with bullets from the Palestinian resistance. However, it was revealed that those bullets matched those coming from Israeli tanks rather than Palestinian fighters. And as the war of disinformation continues, large U.S. corporations like Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, and Comcast suspended their ads on X in protest against his alleged anti-Semitism. This has, of course, been lobbied for by Israel's spy agency, the Anti-Defamation League, for some time. The U.S. government has even issued a statement condemning Musk for the abhorrent promotion of anti-Semitic and racist hate. In October, when Israel cut all electronic communications in Gaza, Musk offered to provide his Starlinks to internationally recognized aid organizations in the Strip. This infuriated the Israelis, who vetoed the idea immediately. While on his trip to the settler entity, Musk commented to Israeli President Isaac Herzog that he supported the idea of re-education camps in Gaza to prevent another generation of resistance. He also commented that he would help establish economic prosperity in the area. With the constant stream of contradictory messages, the battle for the soul of Elon Musk continues.
The World Health Organization has once again sounded the alarm on deepening humanitarian and medical crisis in war-torn Gaza. It has called on the international community to take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing Palestinians in the besieged territory. According to the latest WHO assessments, Gaza has 13 partially functioning hospitals, 2 minimally functioning ones, and 21 that are not functioning at all.
There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functional. Still treating patients but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada, and Al-Sahaba Hospital. So these hospitals are still sheltering also thousands of displaced people. At Al-Ahli, about 10 staff, all junior doctors and nurses, continue to provide basic first aid, pain management, as much as possible, wound care, and trauma stabilization services.
The Nasser Medical Complex, which is the most important referral hospital in southern Gaza, is partially functioning. The world body has expressed concern about reports of residential areas being ordered to evacuate around the hospital, which are extremely concerning. According to WHO reports and eyewitness accounts, when military activities intensify near the hospital, ambulances, patients, staff, and WHO and partners are unable to reach the complex. The world body has also said that it is working to strengthen and expand the existing struggling health system.
WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the northern Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs medicines, medicines won't make a difference, and all patients will die slowly and painfully.
It has also expressed concern about the fresh wave of displacement of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, who have been pushed by Israel to move to further south. It says the displacement of people will further strain health facilities in the south, which are already struggling to meet the population's immense needs. The WHO statement read, "This forced mass movement of people will also lead to more overcrowding, increased risk of infectious diseases, and make it even harder to deliver humanitarian aid. Most of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are grappling with terrible injuries, acute hunger, and severe risk of disease." WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom has also repeated a call on the international community to, quote, take urgent steps to alleviate the grave peril facing the population of Gaza. The remarks come a day after the WHO staff went on a high-risk mission to deliver humanitarian supplies to the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza and Al-Amal Palestine Red Crescent Society in southern Gaza. Both hospitals serve as shelters for displaced Palestinians seeking safety amid relentless Israeli bombardment. At Al-Shifa Hospital, a reported 50,000 people are sheltering, while 14,000 others are at Al-Amal.
Seen children, women, young men, old men and women, people bleeding out. I, at the same time yesterday at Al-Aqsa, I saw a woman who had multiple gunshot wounds. An attempt was made to refer her, and she was referred back because she was bleeding so heavily. So, I mean, there's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged.
Comments come as Israel is pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. From corpses lying unattended on the streets, to hospitals and schools reduced to rubble, to children made orphans and tens of thousands of people rendered homeless, the gory events unfolding in the besieged Gaza Strip since October 7 are a textbook example of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The death toll in the coastal territory since the Israeli regime launched its indiscriminate aerial and ground attacks nearly 3 months ago is now over 21,000, most of them children and women. Almost all refugee camps have been rendered uninhabitable due to random strikes, forcing the majority of the population to sleep under the open sky amid heavy winds and heavy downpours. The barbaric attacks were only meant to give an image of victory to its defeated army, which has only succeeded in killing unarmed civilians and destroying civilian facilities.
This is really the worst thing that U.S. and Israel could do to Palestinians. The genocide is the heinous war crimes are gone unnoticed.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij, Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about Homs or some of the jurisprudential laws around it based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked this question. I bought a car several years ago, and at the present time, it might sell for a price several times more than what it is purchased for. As Khums was not paid on the money spent to buy it, and I am planning to buy with its proceeds a house to live in. Does Khums apply to the entire amount once I receive it? Or does it apply only to the money that I paid to buy the car, while the balance, or that is the difference of the sale value over the original price of the car, while the balance is considered as part of the earnings of the year in which the car is sold, and as a result is subject to khums if the money is not spent on living expenses by the end of the khums year?
Yeah. If the car was a part of your ma'una or a part of your living expenses, and it was purchased spending the income of the same khums year for personal use,
mm-hmm.
there's no khums on its proceeds. So, but in case you bought the car spending the income of the same khums year to be used for work, as I did discuss this issue in one of the previous episodes. So you bought the car to use it for work, to make money with it. You should pay khums on it. And of course, khums should be paid on the current market value of the car. And it's not paid on the original price or on original value. And the increase in the event that there is an increase in its value during the next years, of course, after the, for example, because in some countries there is a lot of inflation, the cars and property go up, they shoot up, and the prices go up because of the inflation. Now the inflation has to be subtracted from the money or from the proceeds, and then if there is anything that, if the price goes up and then the there is anything that you have benefited in the same year, of course, khums should be paid.
Mm-hmm.
Khums should be paid on the proceeds.
Mm-hmm. I see. Another person asked, Sheikh Shabit, I owned a very modest house, but for some reason, I decided to buy another house. Due to debts, I was forced to sell the car, which I was using, and borrow some money from the provincial bank and Ribafri bank or loan institution in our city to pay for the house. As the sale of the car occurred before the beginning of my Khums year, and I spent the money obtained from its sale to pay off a part of my debts, does Khums apply to the money obtained from the sale of the car?
Mm. That is a good question. Well, if you bought the car using the income you earned during the same Khums year, but sold it after the end of the Khums year, you are not to pay Khums on the proceeds. Now, this is the short answer.
After or before the Khums year?
Because it doesn't make any difference. If you, for example, buy a car with the income you earned in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before the end of the Khums year,
there is no Khums.
There is no Khums.
Yes. But what about after
the Khums? Because there is no Khums, because you bought it with the income and you used that car. That's the point.
I see.
You used that car and you earned the money with...
It's part of your life or living expenses?
Yeah, it's part of your expensive.
Uh-huh, okay.
Expenses. And that's why Khums is not paid on that money.
But what about the house, the second house that he bought?
The question is, was about the second house or about the money that comes from the proceeds of the sale?
The proceeds, but I'm just asking out of my curiosity.
Yeah.
Because he has two houses now.
Okay.
So one of the houses is applicable to Khums, isn't it?
Of course, because if he is a small family with two or three, let's say, people in that family,
uh-huh.
and there is another house he has, probably he has bought it for investment or for any other purposes, no matter, because he needs only one house, so Khums should be paid on that, on the second house, if he had never paid Khums on the asset or on the money which he used to buy that house.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Because there's also a scenario, probably,
yes.
if he bought that house with the money he borrowed from the bank, okay, as you mentioned in your question, he bought it. He got some loan from the Riba Free
yes.
Bank, and then he bought the house. Now the house, he has to wait and see if he pays off the installments, and then the house comes under his control. Because as long as you do not pay the installments, the
mm-hmm.
house probably will be
the property of the bank.
Yeah, it belongs to the bank.
Yes.
So once you pay the installments, the house comes to your possession. It's transferred to you. And now the house is there. You have not paid Khums on the principal amount, and nor on the house. So in this case, of course, you have to pay Khums.
Does it make a difference if you borrow some loans or money from a Riba Free bank or any kind of bank in the West?
Well,
which we do not know whether it's usury based or not.
Of course, it's usury based.
Yes,
but. Because of emergency situation, or because there is an urgent need without which we cannot, for example, solve our
mm-hmm.
problem.
Yes.
There is a need, a very strong need to take a loan or receive a loan from the bank. And because of this very reason, there's no objection to you to receive that loan, even if you know that you will end up paying the not only the principal amount but also the interest,
mm-hmm.
Since you are compelled to do so, there is no objection to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Shabit. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh with our guest speaker. We are still talking about Khums, or some of the jurisprudential laws about Khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, when a house or a car or any other necessities of the life that a person or a family needs and were purchased, these items were purchased from the annual income, are sold on account of the necessity or to replace them with items of superior quality. What's the ruling in this regard? I mean, regarding homes.
Yeah, of course, this is something that always happens to us in our day, in our lives, because there are things that are, let's say, outdated. There are, for example, items that are obsolete. You don't need them. You cannot use them because they malfunction. Sometimes they are very dangerous. Like, for example, a broken car you are still trying to use or fix. So you want to replace them with a new one. There is no problem. The proceeds from the sale of these things, from these, the sale of these items, which you have been using, obviously, are not subject to khums.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. How about some kind of, order or slips that some people get from some institutions for future investment? Like, for example, they're given this promise of a piece of land somewhere.
Yeah.
All right. By paying a special amount or a certain, like, limited, sum of money. Then they're promised that piece of land later. And then later they can, for example, pay installments, not because of the fact that they have bought a house and are using it, but because they're going to use it later, or they're going to own that piece of land or that apartment later, for example, by a governmental institution or even a kind of private sector.
I think we talked about this in one of the questions you raised about house purchased, for example, on some kind of lease, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the money that is paid in and at once, it's one of the ways through which one has to buy a house or take possession of a house, unless you pay some money or deposit some money with a company or with a bank, you will not be able to own a house.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, there's no homes paid on that money that goes towards that's paid in an advancement.
Okay.
An advance, yes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, signing off. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kazemiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholar lives of the most outstanding Sahabi or the companions of the Shiite infallible Imams. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadahi are the special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom for today's discussion. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadahi, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding figure who is believed to be the first Naib or the special deputy or representative of Imam al-Mahdi Ajjalallah during the minor occultation. He is no one but Osman ibn Sayyid Amri. We will talk more about what is Niaba, what is Naib, what does it mean to be among the Nawab al-Arba'a or the four special deputies of Imam. As before anything, Sheikh Rouhani, who was he exactly, Osman ibn Sayyid al-Amri?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Osman ibn Sayyid al-Amri was the first deputy of Imam al-Mahdi Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. And he was also among the companions of Imam al-Jawad, Imam al-Hadi, and Imam Hassan al-Askari. So he actually accompanied three other imams as well, in addition to Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif.
Yes.
And then, of course, there are some doubts regarding this, that whether he was among the Imam al-Jawad's companions or not. But what is well known about him is this, that he was also the companions of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salatu wassalam, as well.
Yes.
So, of course, he was the special deputy of Imam al-Mahdi since the beginning of the imamate of Imam al-Mahdi until the end of his life, about 6 or 7 years later. So, In all this time, he was among the representatives and naib of the Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif.
Safir, they also use Safir al-Awwal.
Yes, Safir al-Awwal, of course. Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
Yes, Osman becomes the Imam's deputy, and then since he was the deputy, Osman went actually to Baghdad and spent his deputation there in Baghdad and other cities of Iraq. And he had agents who received religious kind of texts from the people and sent it to the Imam. And then, upon his demise, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif, sent a letter of condolence to his son. In hadith sources, it is mentioned. So that's why he had a very, great status for the Imam, particularly for the Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif.
All right. Okay, Sheikh Fadahi, as we said, he was As-Safir al-Awwal, the first naib, the first special deputy to Imam Asr. So, first of all, talk about this position of him. What was this position to be As-Safir or naib to Imam Asr? What are the main duties of this person? And why at all Imam Asr selected such people as the, intermediary between himself and the people around?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, first of all, it's good to talk about the reason why.
Yes.
For that, it's better to go a little backward and talk about the position of imama. Yes. You know, after Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we had 12 imam, and as Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam formed a government, all imams wanted to have this position, not just as a will and want, as a duty from God. There is a book called A 250-Year Man.
Yes.
In Persian, Insan-e Devist-e Panjah Saleh, which is a collection of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei's lectures about imams. You know, the result and summary is that these imams are as one soul, and all of them were after government.
Yes.
They had to form a government. Some of them, like Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was successful to have this position and to be the responsible of Islamic society. But the others, they couldn't. But it doesn't mean that they didn't want. They didn't want to have a position of being a caliph for Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They wanted. And because of that, the Amavid and Abbasid caliphs, they tried to, first of all, they tried to have imams in the prisons,
yes,
or, I don't know, in the military bases,
yes,
under controls.
Yes.
And after all, when they realized that they cannot control imam, they killed imams one after each other.
Yes.
So when it comes to Imam Hassan al-Askari, they knew from the riwayats and ahadith of prophets and their imams, previous imams, that after Imam Hassan al-Askari, the last one, the next one,
yes,
will destroy the caliphate.
Yes.
They destroyed every oppressor.
Yes.
So because of that, they didn't want to have that imam from the beginning,
mm-hmm,
not to have it under control.
Okay.
They wanted to kill him.
Yes.
You know, the story is like the story of Moses, alayhi salam.
Yes.
After Moses had a struggle with one of his enemies and killed him,
mm-hmm,
he exited the city, and in Quran we have فَخَرَجَ خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبْ.
Yes.
I mean, he left the city,
yes,
because he didn't have the security of life,
mm-hmm,
and he was hopeful to get back.
Yes.
Imam Zaman was like that. Enemies wanted to kill him,
mm-hmm,
in order not to have an opponent,
yes,
in front of them.
That's
so fine. Imam Zaman kharaja khaifan,
yes,
it means he left the Islamic society, apparently,
yes,
not in reality, because he didn't have the security of life, but he's hopeful to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lot
yes,
of time until,
yes,
now. So, but it was not just to leave the society without anyone to control the society, to do the jobs, because people, or it's better to say Shiites, didn't have access to imams.
Yes.
So there was a need for this access.
Mm-hmm.
So if imam wanted to have apparent access with Shiites, so they would find him,
yes,
and kill him.
Yes. Or imprison him at least.
Imprison.
That's right. Okay.
So because of that, imam decided, of course, by the order of God,
yes,
decided to have some representative,
yes,
to do the duties of imamet.
Mm-hmm.
So these representatives, these four representatives, they did whatever imam wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that they were something like king or, I don't know, like caliph.
Okay.
No, just representative.
Okay.
So Shias could have access to imam, but indirectly. So there isn't any difference between direct access or indirect access. Nowadays, we don't have any direct access,
yes,
to Prophet and imams.
Yes.
But we are Shia. We know our duty.
Okay.
So this representation or vekala or niaba,
yes,
this was a solution for access,
mm-hmm,
to imam.
That's right.
So, of course, there are a lot to say.
Yes.
We can continue.
Yes. Okay, that's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And through different ways, he was responsible to send the messages, or it's better to say, to convey the messages of Imam As to the people. They say Osman was called Samman and Zayat too, because he was selling oils and the olives. So through this job, we can say, or occupation, he was selling them and in fact sending the messages of Imam As to the people. But Sheikh Rouhani, what are the main duties of a safir, of an imam? Sheikh Fadai said that he has not absolute power to do anything he likes. He is under the order, or it's better to say, he abides by the orders of Imam As. But what are exactly his duties?
You know, first of all, we should know that the situation was so much difficult for the imams, because they were living in Samarra, which was like a kind of, let's say,
military camp
or bases, the Abbasid, let's say, kings. So that's why this Osman ibn Sa'id moved to Baghdad. As you rightly mentioned, in Baghdad, he was living and also selling some things as a seller. He was living there, but of course, because of the lots of problems that imams faced, particularly Imam al-Asr arwahuna fida, so his duty and his, let's say, responsibility was this, that to be like a kind of a deputy or a kind of representative for the imam. And of course, he was also the representative of the people to the imam, because from both sides, he was like a representative, a deputy. So Imam actually sent some letters, some orders, commandments, pieces of advices, sometimes nasa'ih, for example,
the religious questions and the jurisprudential questions of the people were answered to the Imam?
Of course, yeah. Okay. And these, let's say, letters or orders of the Imam were given to Osman ibn Sa'id.
Yes.
And then Osman ibn Sa'id transferred them to the people or give them to the people.
Okay.
And then sometimes the people referred to this Osman ibn Sa'id. As he was, because he was introduced by the Imam himself as his representative, as his deputy.
So it was officially
in many occasions,
Okay.
So that's why he also received the questions of the people and then give it to the Imam, and then receive the responses of the Imam and then give it back to the people.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the main responsibility of Osman ibn Sa'id as the deputy of Imam al-Asr. Arwahuna fida.
That's right.
He was not only the deputy of this imam, he was also the deputy of Imam al-Hasan al-Askari, Imam al-Hadi as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Samarra, he accompanied all these imams. So that's why he was the most, let's say, important representative of the imam.
That's all right. A really outstanding and great position. Okay, Sheikh Fatahi, so all in all, in here, we could see that this is happening during Ghibat al-Sughra, isn't it?
Yes,
the minor occultation of Imam As. And for how many years, it's better to say, Osman ibn Sa'id al-Amri was in charge of being representative to the Imam?
Imam Mahdi was born in the year 255.
Okay.
And when he was in the age 5, his father demised, passed away.
Yes.
And it means that he became Imam.
Yes.
When he was 5, and it is not strange, because they are not usual and ordinary people.
Yeah.
And from the beginning of the time of his imamah, he had to be hidden from the eyes of kingdom.
Yes.
And even we have in the history that Imam Hasan al-Askari didn't tell anyone about the birth of his child.
Okay.
And even his mother, the mother of Imam Zaman, didn't have the sign of pregnancy.
Yes.
So the minor occultation started from the first year of his imamah. It means 260.
Yes.
And about 70 years, this minor occultation lasted.
Okay.
It means from the year 260 up to 329.
So, sorry, Osman ibn Sa'id al-Amri as
and
the first safir.
The first one was Imam's deputy and safir for 6 or 7 different records.
Seven years. So from age 5 of Imam?
When Imam was 5, he was Imam's na'ib.
So now this is a grown-up man, a mature man who has to...
That is the real velaya. He is a mature one, as we think and we see. And his Imam is a child.
But they
know that in the subject of imamah, age doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the problems about this age We had about Ja'far al-Kazzab.
Yes.
He was the uncle of Imam al-Zaman.
Yes.
And he claimed that, come on, it's just a boy,
child.
Just
yeah.
a child.
I am the
and
Imam.
I'm a mature man, uh-huh. and I'm Imam's brother.
Uh-huh.
So this position of Imam had
yes.
to come to me.
Uh-huh.
But it is not like that.
Yes.
And
there's this also, Imam has asked, send a letter to Osman.
Yes,
and
denied him.
And denied him, that's right. That he
and
is not
even Ja'far al-Kazzab wanted to have the ceremony of burying the Imam and uh-huh. to have the Salat of Mayyit.
Yes.
Imam Zaman didn't allow him. So about 70 years, we had the minor occultation, and the first Naib was Imam's deputy and Safi for mm-hmm. at most 7 years.
That's right.
Osman ibn Sa'id Amri.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of this outstanding man. As you said, a grown-up man who is obeying the orders of a child, his imam, at the age of five, and then see how much imam is knowledgeable in that age, could answer the questions of so many people, answer the queries, you know, on that time. This must be very much outstanding and outstanding episode of the history of the Shiite Islam. The exact date of the demise of Osman ibn Sa'id al-Amri is not known, but maybe it is 267 according to the Hijri calendar. He passed away in a neighborhood called Ad-Darb or Ad-Dorb, maybe Ad-Darb, that's right, in Baghdad, and he is buried over there. It is believed that Sheikh Al-Tusi used to pay visit to the tomb of this outstanding man in the city of Baghdad from years 408 to 430, and that's the region in Baghdad. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher, which was about the first Naib or Safir al-Awwal, the first special deputy of Imam Asr, Osman ibn Sa'id al-Amri. May Allah and Imam Asr accept our struggles in spreading the religion of Islam and the teachings of the Shiite Islam, inshallah. For more information on this program, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The collective hardship experienced by Gaza's female prisoners in Israel is unprecedented even within the tragic history of the Zionist regime's treatment of Palestinian prisoners. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote the names of 51 female prisoners kidnapped by invading Israeli regime forces during their ground operation in Gaza have been revealed. This number was announced by the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Authority in a statement without confirming whether there are other female prisoners secretly abducted by the Zionist regime. Regardless of the exact number, however, the testimonies that were collected from released prisoners, several shocking abuse, ill-treatment, and torture. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with Lama Khater from Al-Khalil, who was abducted on October 26 and released under prisoner exchange deal between the Zionist regime's government and the Palestinian resistance on November 30. Khater was abducted along with 10 female prisoners from Gaza and was witnessing the abuse they were subjected to. Qatar said the conditions of female prisoners from Gaza were particularly difficult, starting with their kidnapping during their displacement from the northern Gaza Strip. She stressed, they were arrested randomly, mostly from the northern Gaza Strip. Israeli soldiers detained mothers too, who have been forced to leave their children with passers-by. Khater recounted that before arriving at Daman prison, the female detainees were left without covers, subjected to humiliating strip searches, and forced to sleep on the bare floor. When they were brought into prisons, they were blindfolded, handcuffed, and deprived of their hijab, said Khater. They were reportedly placed in narrow cells in Daman prison and not allowed to speak to the rest of the female prisoners from the occupied West Bank and Palestine 48. Khater said, all female prisoners are subjected to great restrictions, but the prisoners from Gaza were treated even worse. For example, they are only allowed to shower in large groups of at least 50 women and for not more than 15 minutes a day. Khater said that on December 10th and 11th, five female prisoners from the Gaza Strip were taken out of Daman prison. Their current location is not yet known. Among the female Gazan prisoners, some are in a particularly difficult state. An 80-year-old woman who suffers from Alzheimer's and a pregnant woman. Both are subjected to medical negligence. The Palestine Chronicle also spoke with Palestinian lawyer Hassan al-Abadi, who collected the testimonies of several female prisoners in Daman. Al-Abadi, who volunteered to visit the female prisoners, submitted his first request to the Zionist regime's prison administration on November 30, but was told in response that there were no longer female prisoners in the detention facility. A few days later, however, media reports revealed that dozens of female prisoners from Gaza, Al-Quds, and Palestine 48 were still held there. Al-Abadi confirmed to the Palestine Chronicle that there are over 40 female prisoners from Gaza in the facility, but they are prohibited from seeing a lawyer, he said. When I would visit any female prisoner from the West Bank or Al-Quds, she would tell me about the harsh conditions of detention of the prisoners from the Gaza Strip. Al-Abadi said he was particularly disturbed by the way the Zionist regime forces transported the female detainees from Gaza to the prisons. According to the lawyer, they were placed in trucks carrying cages similar to those used for animal transport. Al-Abadi said, this detail particularly hurt me. These women have been transported in animal trucks. They have been tied, blindfolded, and stripped of their head covering as a way to humiliate them. The lawyer also said that when the female detainees arrived at the prison, their clothes were stained with blood. Most of them were also bleeding from their hands, as the plastic chains have been tightly tied around their wrists for days. Upon their arrival, they were distributed into three rooms, each containing six iron beds. Most of them were reportedly forced to sleep on the floor without pillows or mattresses. Al-Abadi said the prisoners told me that the food is also very bad and that the Israeli guards deliberately leave it on their cell door for hours until it turns cold. The water has a rusty taste as well. The female detainees from Gaza are even forbidden from talking to the rest of the prisoners and they have to communicate in secret. Al-Abadi shared that one of the women had to leave her four children in Gaza. The eldest was only 8 years old, the youngest an infant. According to the testimony from other prisoners, the woman was walking on Salahuddin Street fleeing from the north of the Gaza Strip when the Israeli regime troops kidnapped her. Al-Abadi said when she learned that she would be under arrest, she immediately handed her children to a boy who was walking in the street and told him to take care of them. I learned from the other prisoners that she asked about her children every day, crying inconsolably, but nobody was updating her on their fate. A few days ago, however, Al-Abadi was able to deliver a verbal message to this woman that her children had eventually reached their father. He said, this time she cried out of joy. Al-Abadi said these women are not only suffering due to the extremely cruel conditions of their detention, but because they are constantly concerned about their families. They do not know the fate of their children as the Zionist regime continues to relentlessly bombard Gaza. Al-Abadi explained they are not allowed to hear the news or follow what is happening anyway. They are isolated from the outside world and don't know anything. But there are other forms of violation carried out by the Israeli regime authorities. Al-Abadi told us that the prison administration prevents these women from bringing along the necessary things. Therefore, they only have what they were wearing at the time of arrest. The Zionist regime considers men and women detained in the Gaza Strip to be prisoners of war under the so-called unlawful combatants law. Therefore, it prevents them from having contact with lawyers and human rights organizations.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8 Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English.